Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Zadie Smith, whose most recent novel is On Beauty. Earlier novels include White Teeth and Autograph Man. On Beauty just came out in trade paperback. Zadie Smith, I want to talk about your career, but first let's talk a little about On Beauty. On Beauty transposes, in a way, E.M. Forster's stratified class society into the American college structure. How did that come about? How did you reach that decision to do that?
It's interesting because decisions like that when you're writing, which seems so fundamental after the fact, are so, when I make them anyway, so ambivalent and so accidental. I had the idea for the story. I kind of dreamt the structure of the families. And then I was telling my husband about it, and he said, oh, that's very nice, dear, but it's quite like Howard's End. I said, yes, you're right. And obviously quite like Romeo and Juliet and quite like a million, you know, culture clash stories. I was quite interested in the idea of literary update, and I was thinking of Graham Swift, updated As I Lay Dying, and I guess in more popular version is the Bridget Jones books of Pride and Prejudice, and just that idea of being in a kind of echo tunnel with the writers who came before you, and using it as a way to admit influence and also shake off influence, because I think I'm a very influenced writer. I think the book was a summing up of my academic life and my life as a reader, so it came together quite naturally.
Were a lot of the decisions conscious then or unconscious, you think?
Well, my feelings have changed about that. You know, if you'd asked me when I was 19, when I started writing, I was, very much the logical positivist, and I thought all my decisions were conscious, and I was a very rational novelist. And as you get older, and this is true of one's personal life as well, it becomes clear that you're driven by much deeper and more subconscious forces than you thought. So a lot of it was subconscious, and things that I realise I keep on returning to, like family structures, are not really choices, actually. They're things I can't help.
As you become more conscious of your, say, lack of consciousness, do you think it makes you freer as a writer then? Or
The main difference is made it me much freer as a critic. Because when I was young, and I was writing, I suppose, essays then and a few reviews, because I was so sure that authors had nothing to do with their work and I separated them so rigorously because that's what I'd been taught, I was tying my hands together as a critic, and now I'm writing these essays and realising that the currents of the self are some of the most profound parts of literature. So that's been very freeing, and I don't feel like I'm under the cosh of the kind of French literary theory that I was a real slave to when I was an undergraduate. I feel much freer, yeah.
How conscious, then, was the Forster-Howard's End template in working on the book? I mean, when you come to a key point like the painting.
Well, the big thing was I didn't read Howard's End. I didn't reread it, but it's a book I know so well that that didn't really make any difference. It was already there. You know, the truth is, I think when you're a youngish writer, you always look for scaffolding to kind of support your fictions, and that's true of all my novels. And then when you finished, I think you realise the scaffolding, maybe you could have done without it, or it could have been removed. But it's just part of what you, for me anyway, the confidence needed to make the novel in itself. You need quite a big ego and quite a lot of confidence to think, here I am sitting at this blank page, I'm going to make this extraordinary structure. And I find that hard sometimes, and I suppose I look to tradition for support and to validate what I do sometimes.
What was the scaffolding for Autograph Man or White Teeth?
Well, in the Autograph Man, it's entirely theoretical. Like it's not for the reader to bore themselves trying to work out all the various structures in Autograph Man, but, you know, I spent an incredible amount of time reading Judaica and a lot of time reading Zen, and I structured the book along kind of ancient patterns and various symbols and numerology symbols, and it was pointed out to me recently that the chapters are exactly identical. There's 22 chapters as there are 20 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, all those kind of things. And those things are partly, I guess, to entertain the writer, but very in a much more practical way, they're a way of getting through what's an enormous, amorphous act. You know, to me, it's like when I'm jogging, if I can say 2 more miles or 3 more miles,
right,
I can get through it. But if you just say run, I'm not going anywhere. It fills with desperation.
How about White Teeth? Did you have a scaffolding there? Was that just the expansion of a short story?
And of course, you have to be me to know these things, but it was definitely the result of a great deal of ideological study. You know, like White Teeth, though it is a fiction, if you get away, kind of scrape away all the fiction, it's various theories, anthropological theories and sociological theories that were fashionable at the time. I suppose that's what I dislike about it when I look back on it. A lot of the characters are forced into positions which aren't genuine or truthful or necessary, but just were the end of certain kinds of arguments. So White Teeth is written like an essay, because at the time I was a student, and that's how I knew how to write.
now when you look on it, you see yourself as a puppeteer?
You know, I never read White Teeth, so even my memories of it are completely right. distorted, and I only know it from what people say to me. But I do think when I finished On Beauty, I had a feeling of extraordinary relief, which neither of the other books gave me, and I think it was because I was putting to bed the preoccupations of my childhood and of my life so far, and I think I was done, if you see what I mean.
You but got rid of that book.
Yeah, with a certain type of novel and ideas that have interested me, for 30 years, and then I'm finished now, so I feel very liberated.
There's a thread running through all your books. Multicultural people, people who come from mixed race, mixed ethnic background, from you on down. And I keep thinking that one of the reasons that a lot of younger people are drawn to your writing in particular is because so many people have that mix, and yet very few writers write about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's my experience. I think in England and America, it's very hard to find what a racial purist would call a pure person. It was almost impossible. And once you factor in things like Judaism and the things which aren't, you know, genetically obvious on the surface, you know, that there aren't any. There's no such thing as a pure American, or they're extraordinarily hard to find, and the same with a pure Englishman. So I think for a lot of my generation, the idea of being either English or American is about commitment. So I consider myself very English, but that's because I care for England. I care for its literature and its films and its poetry and its people and its food and its landscape. And to me, that's what makes up a country's identity. It's not. It can't be something passing through the blood. That's too accidental and completely irrelevant. The football thug who's on the terraces, who doesn't know Henry V. Well, how English is he? I don't know. Not so English to me. So I think that's part of it. But also, there are deep structures in people's work that you can't avoid. So there are writers who will always, if they're having writing about a family, have two brothers because they had two brothers, and to them, a family is two brothers. And I suppose to me, it's very hard to get out of my mind the idea that a family contains some fundamental difference. It's hard to shake that off because that's the only kind of family I know.
I think a lot of people have that. I mean, my family is multicultural. And I look at that, and what I see is both an ethnic mixing, but at the same time a certain dislocation, because you don't fit into a particular expectation. You can't.
You know, from my experience, when people come to my readings, even if the family is completely white and has been white for 500 generations, difference is what living is about. You know, men being married to women is as fundamental a difference as you can possibly imagine. The idea that people have of families, the idea you see in the adverts, it goes to nobody's life. Nobody's life is like that. Everybody's life is full of these strange secrets and divisions and troubles.
Zadie Smith, let's talk a little about some of the characters in On Beauty. The central character appears to be the Professor Howard, a white man married to a Jamaican woman, three kids. One critic that I read made the comment that what's odd about him is that even though he's the central character, his philosophy, his aesthetic philosophy, seems to be totally different from that of Zadie Smith. I mean, you're not writing yourself there. You're avoiding it.
That's true, but Howard is a kind of version of me. I had some very strict opinions about aesthetics when I was younger, and I have some sympathy for his point of view. You know, all Howard's trying to do is stop people thinking in a second-hand, dull or received way. You know, he's just trying to make you think, well, what is it about Rembrandt that's of worth? Don't just tell me he's a genius and he's a great painter and has always been. So Howard's just he's a bit of an agitator, an intellectual agitator in that way. And he's, I suppose he's morally cowardly, which I relate to a great deal. And he's kind of a shirker of life's responsibilities. I'm also quite like that. You know, sometimes how you look on the surface is not how you are inside. And people assume that I'm like Zora, I guess, because she's the mixed-race girl about my age. But, you know, there's a lot of grumpy middle-aged man in me. You'd be surprised.
He's also not particularly sympathetic and actually becomes less sympathetic. Yet a friend of mine noticed and made comment that one of the reasons he loves your books is because on some level it seems that you do love all your characters.
You know, my husband always says about me that in my real life, even if somebody's clearly horrendous, I'm always interested. You know, my husband's much more the type of person who finds horrendous people personally offensive. So he doesn't want to spend time with someone who talks nonstop or someone who has offensive views. But I find those kind of people fascinating. I don't know why. I never take it personally. I find awful people as interesting as nice people, which is worrying, I think. I think you do need to, at some point, lay down the law about, you know, what you will take and what you won't take. But I don't think I'm the only writer to have a certain ambivalence when it comes to other people. I'm not so horrified by them that I don't want to stay and watch.
I know that many thriller writers, for instance, love their villains more than their heroes.
Absolutely, and I'm very curious about other people's families, and there are all kinds of people. I say, in England, for instance, an aristocratic family, which I suppose a lot of people would find tedious or painful or not interesting to be around. I'm very fascinated by that kind of thing, like excessive money or family going back generations that you have to somehow live up to or respect. Things which are very different from my life, I suppose. The instinct is voyeuristic in me.
When you're creating a character like the conservative, the black conservative, Kipps, I mean, to some degree, he's almost that white, upper-class British guy transposed into a different race.
Well, you know, there are people like that. A good example, I think a lot of people thought Kipps was based on, but he isn't, is Naipaul, V.S. Naipaul, who's about as conservative an Indian Trinidadian Englishman as you could have hoped to meet.
Right.
And I suppose a lot of people do find him offensive, but there's something, I don't know, original and amusing in being so outrageously right-wing in a skin which really doesn't complement any of your ideas. I find that, I don't know, there's something funny about that to me. And I suppose a certain kind of liberal piety which gets me down a little bit. Well, any kind of piety gets me down. But liberal piety is not to be excused just because it's liberal.
I notice that the great conflict in the book is between Howard, our white professor, liberal hero, or protagonist, and this man Kipps, who mostly stays off stage. I was waiting through the entire book to see whether they would ever actually go one-on-one and confront, and they don't really do that.
No, they have an argument in the faculty meeting, which was extremely laborious to write because I personally hate ideological argument, and to have to think about it and then to write it is some of the most painful writing in the book for me. I hate to be inside the minds of people who were following the party line. It's just so depressing. Now, that's true of a few characters in the book. It's true of Monty and it's true of Jerome, and I still haven't settled in my own mind how to write a book where there obviously is a large cast, if you want to, I hate that word to use for book fiction, but there's a large cast, and to keep everybody up in the air at the same time it's a real skill. And if you don't want to write books as long as Bleak House, something's got to give. And in my fiction, usually something does give, but that's still something that I'm trying to perfect, but it's really hard.
I noticed Jerome never actually confronts Victoria, his
no.
ex-girlfriend. And
because so many of these things, if I start writing them, I would be writing forever. In all the books, I could have gone on another 300, 400 pages. I always hope I'm performing a merciful act by stopping where I do.
In some respects, the most sympathetic character is Howard's wife, Kiki, who's this rather large Jamaican woman who is very, very warm, but also not all that forgiving. Nor maybe should she be.
Well, I quite admire Kiki because when she's hurt, she stands by the fact that she's hurt, and she has a strong sense of self, which I think I lack a little bit. I find it hard to remain offended or remain angry or feel slighted in the same way. And I used to think that was a great virtue, but actually I think it's just lily-livered. Whereas Kiki has a sense of herself, and there's a place where, as Americans say, the buck stops. And I think that's worth having some sense of yourself, some sense of the boundaries of your existence and other people's existence. So I quite admire her, but I guess with all characters that I admire, I then make them kind of heroic in some ways because they seem so far from me. So I think she's a little more heroic than she need be. She's unforgiving, but, you know, it's hard for women to deal with the predictability and tedium of being cheated on by middle-aged men. That's very boring.
When you're creating these characters and putting them in a mix and watching what happens and understanding that on some level you're using this Forster template and maybe even an outline, do they at times almost take on lives of their own and push you in directions that you might have thought they shouldn't go, or do you feel you have like total control?
I always used to ridicule when I was a student and hear writers on the radio talking about voices speaking to them and the spirit moving through them and all the rest of it, but I don't plan out a book, so I suppose in that way it has its own velocity because I have no idea what's going to happen, and I just move along with the voices, really, with the dialogue, and then that takes me in various directions. But I suppose I do always feel that I'm in control, I hope.
So the key element of the book that relates it to Howard's End, the painting that the character Carlene gives to Kiki, was that something that came later on in the writing or something you knew would happen?
No, that I knew. In all my books, there's always a question of gift giving, because in cultures like ours, in Western culture, there's almost no conception of gift. I don't mean just here's your Christmas present. I mean the concept of something passed between one human and another human, which isn't connected to commerce or exchange of a financial kind or
quid pro quo
gain. Yeah, it's a very unusual. One of the best examples, you hope, is art. Despite the fact you buy a book or you go to see a movie, there's some element of art which is gifted to you, I believe. And so my characters, a lot of the argument is about how to give a gift and how to give it reasonably without second-guessing yourself and becoming paranoid and self-conscious about it. I know in The Autograph Man, Alex, the gift he has to give is Kaddish to his father, simple ritual that he happens not to believe in. So it's those kind of things that I guess preoccupy me. I have trouble giving gifts myself. I suppose I'm not naturally religious. I'm hard to keep faith. So my books always circle around that, and I'm sure that that's why it was Howard's End. Even though it's not my favourite Forster novel, it's because right at the centre of it there's this idea of a pure gift which is then dissipated.
You're listening to an interview with Zadie Smith, whose most recent novel is On Beauty. When you're looking back on Beauty, and now you've written it, what, 3 years ago, when you think back on it, is there any character you look at that you're going, yeah, I nailed that character, or something where you go, damn, I wish I'd done something differently?
I have a very clear answer to that, because I walked out of the house about 6 months ago and realized a whole third of the book about Jerome for the last part of the book that I didn't write. Never had it so clearly before. It just smacked me between the eyes with such clarity, and that had never happened to me before. If I'd been a bit more patient, thought about it a bit more, it was so obvious, and it's not in the book, and I suppose it never will be in the book. That struck me, and then my main feeling when I finish books is that I have no idea how they were written, or, you know, you go into universities and really lovely students ask you how you did it, and I can't remember, and the book always seems to be a part of me that I can't access when I'm not writing. It's better and cleverer and includes facts that I don't seem to know anymore and ideas that I don't really get. And so that's how I feel.
Do you ever look back and think that there are some subtexts, things that have been bothering you that never surfaced and suddenly you realize afterward there they were?
Well, there's an incident in On Beauty right near the end of the book where Zora punches somebody in the face. And that is a replica of a piece of violin. I've never hit anyone in my life apart from once when I was about 14 years old. So sometimes the delay on an incident is so incredibly long. It was only when I finished writing the scene I thought, oh, that's that day, the only day in my life where I hit somebody in the face. And it took almost 20 years to come out. So it's strange sometimes the subterranean way that things appear in the fiction.
You have a collection of non-fiction coming out?
I have a collection of non-fiction that has an ISBN number, but when it'll be coming out is another thing entirely. It's not finished by any measure. So I'm a little embarrassed. I have to keep on talking about it when I haven't done it. I haven't done the work. But at some point, yes, there will be. It's called Fail Better. It's kind of separate essays on 20th century writers with the underlying idea that writers not only are kind of conduits for tradition like T.S. Eliot thought, and they're not entirely dead like Foucault or Barthes thought, that they have selves. And that one of the things we like in fiction is not just pretty word order, but personality. And when you reject a book, you don't just reject a bad metaphor or a nasty character. You're rejecting a soul, a whole person, a way of being in the world.
I think about that, and then I think about a comment a friend of mine once made, which is that the great thing about being a writer is that in the end, only your best books are remembered.
That's true, but I guess my feeling is that the best books are an expression of personality in a way that critics and I suppose readers don't really imagine or dare to think about, and also that writers continually lie about, because writers have no interest in you thinking of their books as expressions of their personality. When you hear writers talking together intimately out of the way of newspapers or radio stations, then you hear the truth, which is that it really is an exercise in self, and that the things that make writing good or bad are more than just matters of craft. They're also about a refinement of consciousness, and that's a really tricky thing to talk about and to know.
Well, I know whenever I've done writing, it seems to me that the best work is the stuff that flows easiest, that seems to come from somewhere inside me.
Yeah. All of those things, you know, it's very hard to talk about in a critical way, and I, in fact, I wouldn't recommend it for any kind of academic criticism because you end up sounding like a kook or some kind of mad person. But I just wanted to talk about writing as writers talk about it, because that too is true. It's not just academic criticism is true. Writers also know something about what they do. Complaining, for instance, that Alice Munro isn't David Foster Wallace, or, you know, it's no, the comparison of apples and oranges is infuriating to me. Right. In criticism, it's completely pointless. Whereas when I want to see the heart of a writer, I read within their oeuvre, that's much more the point. And then when you see their strengths, you see them clearly for what they are, rather than complaining that an experimentalist isn't like a realist, or a realist isn't like an avant-garde. It's, that's pointless. That's a ridiculous kind of criticism.
The worst for me is the critic who doesn't review the book for what it is, or the movie, but for what they want it to be.
Yes, and that's the other thing the book is about, that criticism, just like writing, is, there's a great phrase by Wallace Stegner who said that writing is a dramatization of belief. Well, so is criticism. And critics need to recognize the way they pursue their beliefs in their criticism. So when I've been writing, I've been trying to be very honest about what I believe, because that's a central part of what you read with. And it's ridiculous to pretend it isn't there.
When you're writing fiction, when you, Zadie Smith, are writing fiction, is it easy for you to silence that critical voice so that you're not saying to yourself, my God, everybody will know who I am on some level?
When I think of personality, I don't mean it as autobiographical facts. I mean, when I define my personality, I say it's my way of being in the world.
So well,
I'm trying to write, I'm trying as accurately as possible through language, which is not a very viable instrument, to express my way of being in the world. And you're exactly right, what compromises, what turns it wrong. All kinds of second-guessing, thinking about readers is incredibly unhealthy. Thinking about critical ideas, fashions of the day, bad dogmas, second-hand ideas, all of those things get in the way of trying to express your way of being in the world. And that's why genius in fiction is extraordinarily rare. The reason there's only a few great books every 30 years is because there's only a few great books every 30 years. There never were any more. There never will be.
Do you find that when you put your own ideas or thoughts into a character's mouth, do you think that's freeing or a trap?
You know, the one thing I would say which makes me more a novelist than a poet, and I think which joins novelists, is that my own views are almost entirely ambivalent. I'm interested in other people's views. It's very hard to imagine the last time I put some strong opinion of mine in a character's mouth. I think the only ones really are in The Autograph Man, and they're about 1940s musicals. So I don't have those kind of feelings, and I covet that kind of Keatsian negative capability. You know, the whole point is to be unsure, uncertain, ambivalent, in doubt. Something about that, combined with some strange commitment of your deepest beliefs, is what writing is. Don't ask me how that works and how the balance works, but that's how I sense it when I'm writing.
Well, a lot of writers I know, when I ask them these kinds of questions, they say, well, I'm exploring this issue.
Yes.
The question is, when you're exploring like that, you can't really come up with an answer. You just come up with multiplicity of answers, I guess.
I think that's true. I mean, it slightly depresses me that in a lot of contemporary writing, the idea is that it's a kind of, I don't know, trumped-up journalism. You choose the issue of the day, then you explore it as you would an op-ed for the New York Times. And to me, that's not what fiction is about, but I understand why people write it. Even the idea of an issue, I guess on beauty I was thinking of a principle, the idea of beauty, and I do kind of wander around it. As I go through it, you're right, I'm working out what I think. But when I get to the end of the book, it's not like a finished conclusion. I haven't settled all my feelings about it, not at all.
I don't know if you really can. Maybe you need to write several books and still walk away ambivalent. I don't know.
I think that's true.
But from what you say, let me ask you this. Do you think fiction writers have a conscious role in political discourse then?
No. And it depresses me the way books are written almost by committee, with these little hooks in, easily picked up for Sunday supplements and for the argument on the radio. And you know, I grew up on Nabokov, and Nabokov's opinion was that kind of fiction was entirely debased. And it's a very obvious choice. Someone like, if you read Lolita, and then you read Pasternak's
Zhivago.
Yes, Zhivago is written with its political intelligence. Lolita is not. But if you want to learn how to be human and how to be a political animal, read Lolita. You know, dogma in fiction kills it dead, but it will always be rewarded. And Pasternak won the Nobel. Nabokov didn't.
Then do you think fiction writers have any kind of responsibility in that area? Or do you think fiction writing is apolitical?
No, it depends. There are fiction writers. Think of someone like Jonathan Franzen, who also happens to have a great political intelligence and to be willing to take part in that conversation. But the idea, particularly in America, that writers are by nature intellectuals is wrong.
Oh, yeah.
There are many writers who are I don't mean that as an insult. They are instinctive artists. And if you want their opinion on the issues of the day, you're not going to get anything interesting or any wisdom about how to live your life. They're not those kind of writers. It does happen that because fiction writing and the language of politics uses the same medium, words, that there is some kind of overlap. But it's not by any nature natural. And I think that intellectual life in writing is rarer than people think it is. It's a different kind of talent. If you want real intellectual thought, you go to Berkeley, talk with the incredible academics. Writers think differently.
Well, I think what it is the nature of metaphor.
Yeah.
You know, metaphor comes from an unconscious place. So to that degree, if you deal with metaphor, which is what fiction is about, then on that level, it can't be the same as nonfiction that way.
Absolutely, and it's quite painful to see writers somehow trying to force their novels into, when they discuss them into these kind of generic political modes, because it's not natural to their fiction, and it's a shame. But then again, I do think that someone like Franzen, he has such a great way of talking politically. He has a great influence. People read him in such masses that it's a noble thing if you can manage it. But no writer should feel forced into that position.
But Zadie Smith, on the other hand, your novels are all strongly political in terms of racial and class tensions.
My only political allegiance, if you ask me, is that I'm a feminist. That's the only ism I would strongly stand up and wave a flag for if I was forced to. So that aspect certainly goes through my novels, because that's what I was brought up in, and my mother was a radical feminist. And so that's my biggest political interest and instinct. But I do bring people together in my books, non-white people, but my main hope for them is that they have the same kind of existential freedoms as the white characters in my book. I don't want them tied down some kind of identity argument. That's not what I mean for them.
Levi, the character, does have identity issues, though.
He does, but you know, the fact that they're racial, that it's not that different from anybody else's problem in the book. His problem is metaphysical. He thinks he's not authentic enough. And it happens that his idea of non-authenticity is not being black enough. But there are a lot of characters in the book who are suffering from a similar, I guess you'd say, postmodern condition, and thinking that they're somehow less authentic than they might be. I suppose my argument, more old-fashioned and existentialist, is it's impossible to be less authentic than you are. And that it would be much a happier world if people weren't seeking something that they already have. How can you be more army or more nosy or more facey? You can't be. You are as you are.
But everybody, I think, on some level, maybe I'm just projecting, sees themselves as inauthentic.
They do. It seems to me the cause of such extraordinary misery. I understand it, and I believe in the betrayal of a deep self. That's true. But I don't believe in authenticity out of some general identity. Levi thinks that there's some general identity that's shared by many people that he should partake of, and I think that's nonsense.
Zadie Smith, let's talk a little about your career. You began working on White Teeth in college, right?
Mm.
As a short story?
Yeah, I wrote a kind of long short story, and then an editor in England, in London, read another short story of mine, which had been printed in a college thing, and asked if I was doing anything longer, if I'd like to come down for a meeting. So I was doing my exams, but I kind of extended the story a bit. They had like a basement computer room, and then I took it to them in the summer, and that's how it began. It's a ridiculous story.
Did you feel at that point any extra pressure?
It was so surreal to me. You know, I had my life planned out. I was going to stay in Cambridge, I hoped, somehow, for the rest of my life, and always be around books and teach books. And I did. I loved to write, but the idea of, you know, I had such an old-fashioned idea. I didn't think there was any such thing as contemporary publishing. I just thought if you wrote a good enough book somehow, it just floated into the world. People read it. I didn't have any idea of a writer as a job, because all the writers I had heard of and read in Cambridge were, you know, long dead, and there was no sense of a publishing industry. So it was kind of a shock. I think the bleakest part was being given the contract, and then, you know, my whole family completely freaking out. And I have phone calls from all my family saying, you know, you're going to be sued. You've got to, because if you don't finish this book, they're giving you this money. To my family, it was like this horrendous responsibility that I couldn't possibly fulfill, and it was going to be a disaster. So that was a strange experience. And it's been strange since then. Yeah.
Well, what was really strange is the book comes out and suddenly you're the it girl.
Yeah, I mean, again, one of the things about experience is that if you only have the experience you have, is you have absolutely nothing to compare it to. So it seems alien and strange to everybody else, but to me, it was my life, you know. And I have no comparison. it was a crazy time, and you know, I'd been on the dole on benefits, whatever you call it here, and then suddenly I was rich and the book was out, and my academic life had disappeared, and you know, it was a very strange time. It went on for a long time, 6 years, without being able to really take a breath.
At what point did you meet your husband, Nick Laird?
Oh, we've known each other since we were 17, 18, when we first came to Cambridge. So I've known him a really long time.
What was his take on this sudden celebrity?
Well, you know, the thing about Cambridge is that it's very hard to impress people there. And my professors were completely horrified by me publishing a contemporary novel, as they called it. And Nick, you know, we've both been writers together, and I just think he thought... It didn't make him think he was any less of a writer or any of my other friends who were writers, because if you're serious about your writing, then whether somebody is published or not is not really relevant. The question is, are they any good?
Right.
And I think he thought that we were still writers going along together. Obviously, he was a poet, and there's a big difference between poetry and fiction anyway, and he always knew that. But I never sensed that our relationship had changed as two kind of student writers hanging out. It was obviously odd, but that doesn't make any difference to, is the writing any good? And as far as that, we're still in the same, you know, contest and the same relationship, still trying to write good stuff.
When you became successful, you went on tours. I read some of those early interviews, and it seemed as if you were really just trying to find a handle on people asking you questions, and you're going, well, wait a second, I'm just a young writer starting out.
I was spectacularly miserable. I mean, I hate to travel. I'd never been away from home. I was very bad at answering questions, or, you know, I wasn't very social in that way. And now, I feel like most people who were very shy as children are not shy now. Like I completely betrayed my childhood self. I don't know who the person is who goes into radio stations and talks nonstop. No, it was a big shock. I felt that I was living a life which just was nothing to do with me, and everything that happened to the book was nothing to do with me. And in a way, that's true. It was a creation of the media and of publishing, and I felt very lost in it.
Well, when you look back on it now, is there any kind of overarching theme, idea, social idea you've learned from having been in the thick of it?
The most obvious thing is that if you are a woman, life is completely... I always knew that. Completely different. And the boys that I came up with around the same time, who'd wrote books at the same time, there's just no comparison. There's no comparison to the way they were treated, the way they were discussed. I had to realize that my face means something. It's like a semaphore. What I wear, what my face does, these are all significant. The photographs matter. All these things I'd never even considered. One of the most frequent experiences was people come to me reading saying, you're so different than I thought you'd be. And what they meant was, your picture means something to me as a various personality, and then you're somebody else. But people don't do that to male faces. They just think, there's a guy who wrote a book. So that was really bizarre. And then, you know, just utterly malicious stuff like being told I'd only been published because of what I looked like. When at the time I wrote my book, I was, I was about 240 pounds. It's very unlikely that I would have been published for that reason. And just the idea that after all your work and all your study, it's still possible, and people don't consider it sexist to say, oh, well, she never would have got it. It's extraordinary. Imagine saying that about a young guy. But the assumption about young men is that they're geniuses. That's what people immediately assume.
Right.
That he must be incredibly brilliant. And the assumption about a young woman is she somehow got through the back door. How did she do that? And that's a bit depressing, but not... I wasn't entirely surprised by it, but it was shocking to have it face on, you know, at me all the time.
How did you feel about reading, or did you avoid reading, criticism of those books, not only White Teeth, but also the follow-up, Autograph Man?
You know, I'm completely masochistic, and I was originally, wanting to be a critic or academic of some kind, so I read everything, and I'm like a lot of writers, I'm not unusual in this, completely disinterested in the good reviews and fascinated by the bad reviews. The good reviews I read them, great. And the bad reviews I kind of pore over and get very interested in. But the big difference is I was so amenable when I was younger. I wanted to transform myself. You're like, you don't like this part of the book? I'll just change it. Where, of course, again, it's a question of personal commitment. What do you believe about writing? What do you think good writing is? Not what some other guy tells you. You have to know. Otherwise, you can't be the writer that you're meant to be. So I'm less bendable, but I'm still always interested in the opinion of other people, because when you write, you lose all perspective. It just vanishes.
Also, when you're in the celebrity world and everybody's telling you how brilliant and wonderful you are, doesn't that throw you off too? Or did they not do that?
The assumption it just doesn't work like that, because first of all, the so-called celebrity world is miniature compared to the internet world, which is just a land of non-stop 24-hour abuse. So that counters any flattery you might get, you know, in an average day. And also, you know, I have a very Protestant instinct. It doesn't mean anything to me that someone lavishes praise unless I think it's good. It doesn't help me out that someone thinks it's really good. And also, it matters to me very much, well, who is this person? Are they clever? Do they know what they're talking about? Do they have good taste in books? I can't take indiscriminate praise just because it's praise. It doesn't... there's that black African-American thing of saying eyes on the prize, and that's true. My eyes are on a different prize, and it's more serious to me. It's not that I'm so humble and I'm so wonderful at turning away fame. It's just that I want a different kind of fame. I want a good book for all time, not just because it was in the New York Times this Sunday. That doesn't matter to me.
Zadie Smith, have you started working on another novel?
I have. I've written 2 or 3 pages. I'm trying to restrain myself. I have the whole thing, I think. I can feel it building in me. That's the best way to put it. But I'm very determined to do some normal things, like, you know, have a family and have a normal marriage where we're both in the same place. So I'm not going to write for a while, I think.
A couple other questions. You chose to use your husband's poetry as the poetry of one of the characters in On Beauty. How did that idea emerge?
Quite often when you have a poet or an artist character in the book, you keep on hearing about how their stuff, but you never see it, and I always find that completely infuriating. And secondly, I learnt from White Teeth that if you use the lines of real poetry or real verse or a real piece of hip-hop or anything, you have to pay like $3,000 a line. So it gets very, very expensive. So it's much easier just to shout downstairs, Nick, do you have something, and then for him to give it to me. But also because the poet in the book, you know, in some ways I guess she's ridiculous and she's easy to laugh at, but I didn't want her work to be bad. I wanted her work to be good. It's much harder to dismiss somebody if they have real quality, real intelligence. And Claire's not a bad person. She's a really great teacher. She's a really interesting person. She has some flaws, but everybody has some flaws. But I wanted her to be a rounded person. I wanted her poem to be undismissible. And I can't write poetry.
So did you just ask him, hey, can you write some poetry for me? Did you take already existing?
He'd already written that poem, and we'd both been under the influence of the same book, a book called On Beauty and Being Just, which is a little book of moral philosophy and aesthetics, by Elaine Scarry. He's a professor. But, you know, one of the things about being in a married couple of writers, and I know there's a whole lot of them in America now, is that most of the time you're living the same intellectual life. It can't be disguised. You know, you're reading the same books, you're having the same conversations. So it filters through the books you're writing. And that's a kind of funny relationship, but I really enjoy it. It's like a little university of two people.
Did you help him work on his novel?
I can't help him work on the poetry because I have no idea how to edit poetry or how to... I just don't know anything about that. On the novel, I did help. I did some editing on it, and most of it is just talking through what happens next. We do that to each other and trying to limit the amount of embarrassment. You know, when you're deep in a novel, you go off on these terrible detours that if somebody doesn't tell you to stop can be deeply horrendous. That's what we do for each other.
Well, what I've found in discussing writing with other writers, a lot of it is puzzle solving.
So much. That's exactly what it is. And sometimes talking it out over dinner, you see the key, how to get out of a certain situation. It's got a Chinese puzzle quality. That's what Kafka called it, and it's absolutely true. You have to kind of sort out the little problems and the difficulties, much more important than overarching themes or a certain tone or feeling to the book. It's just unlocking the thing which is in your brain that you have to get onto the page.
How many times or does it change do you feel in the rewrite before you think you've nailed something?
It's only when I came to America that people talked to me about rewrites and drafts. I don't write that way. I write the same page over and over. But by the time I've got to the end, the editing's done because I'm always editing. I don't do a quick draft and then go back over. I edit, you know, piece by piece. And the only unusual thing I think about my process, as they say here, is that when I wake up in the morning to write, I read over everything I've done every time. So towards the end of a novel, that means reading often, you know, 350 pages of writing, except if it's your own writing, as anyone knows, you read it at an extraordinary speed. Takes 2 hours to read a book which would take 9 hours or something for somebody else. So that's what I do, and that's more than enough editing for me, and then give it over to other people.
Do you think that the computer, which gives you the ability to... You're nodding your head. You know the answer to that one.
I think it's a complete disaster. And this new book, the one challenge I wanted to set myself is to try and write it by hand. I can't even write like a card or a letter to someone by hand. I don't know. I feel completely self-conscious and weird and creepy. I can't do it at all. But I absolutely, the problem with fiction since, say, the mid-80s is the cut and paste and Microsoft Word program, which enables the incredible convolutions of sentences and semicolon use, which I'm an addict of, which just doesn't occur to you so much when you're writing by hand. You don't use it as much. I would love to write by hand. I wrote one short story by hand about 10 years ago, and it's noticeably not like anything I've ever written in my life. It makes a difference.
Also, I've noticed you've got these bloated books because it's so easy to write. You're not putting you're not writing by hand where your hand gets tired, or putting a piece of paper in a typewriter.
Absolutely, and the kind of books that give you 5 different adjectives in a sentence, that's the computer, that's the ease of it, and it's something very spiritual and interesting about the idea of being connected to fellow humans for centuries and centuries who wrote with their hand, with a pen. So I quite like that idea, but I find it incredibly difficult.
You're someone, Zadie Smith, who tends to read a lot of older work anyway. Then when you look at newer contemporary material, do you see that kind of difference, not only in size, but in glibness, maybe?
No, I don't believe that there are any more great books published every 50 years than there ever were. I think there's a constant rate of genius in literature, and I don't think it makes any difference. But I do think when a country's in utter turmoil, like America is right now, one of the few bonuses is that you get extraordinary writing. If I were an American, particularly a young American now, I would be amazed at the quality of the writers in this country. It's mind-blowing.
Can you name a few who you think fit in that category?
I think, Geoffrey Eugenides, I think, is incredible. I think Michael Chabon, in terms of a man who can write a novel standing on his head, close by swimming in the bay. I mean, that's a consummate novelist. Michael is extraordinary. David Foster Wallace, England, all these people. I mean, I know in the Bay Area you're used to their names, but from a European perspective, it's a whole lot of talent, you know, all working at the same time. And it's pretty amazing.
Zadie Smith, when you look at America as somebody from England and someone who's lived here, where do you see us in 2006? I mean, to me, living in Berkeley, of course, I feel like I'm on an island.
You know, I'm a shameful opter-outer. After about 2003, I started thinking, I just want to live my pathetic little existential life until it's over. It's awful. And I think that's a terrible way of pursuing your life, but I just, ideologically, personally, I gave up completely.
How about over there? You think Blair's replacement is going to be a good thing then?
Gordon's, you know, he's a good man. He's an intelligent man. It's harder in England because we're so small and what's happened has so radically transformed us. I don't know if we'll ever come back again, at least to the place that I really adore. So I suppose I do think about living my little England in my little way and until it's over for me. But I hope you need new leaders to invigorate you maybe and to fill you with hope. Just being in the hallway of your radio station, seeing all these leaflets of protest and community rising up and people making, it's extraordinary to me because I feel mentally and emotionally exhausted by the past 6 years. But maybe a new leader, younger people who are invigorated and determined, that would be great.
You've been listening to an interview with Zadie Smith, whose most recent novel is On Beauty. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.